This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Last week, a large-scale cyber attack knocked offline whole sections of the internet. Popular internet websites, including Twitter, Amazon, Spotify, PayPal, and CNN, were rendered disabled for several hours. While still much is unknown about who was responsible for this attack, many have speculated that it was perpetrated by a state actor, such as Russia or China, and that it's a dire indication of things to come. But why, and to what end? Well, not everyone is convinced that future cyber warfare will play out as so many policymakers have imagined. A few weeks ago, the Hinckley Institute of Politics hosted Brandon Valeriano. Valeriano is a reader at Cardiff University in the United Kingdom and the Donald Bren Chair of Armed Politics at the Marine Corps University in Virginia. He also serves as an adjunct fellow at the Niskanen Center, a libertarian think tank based in Washington, D.C. His research is focused on cybersecurity, popular culture, race and ethnicity politics, and international conflict. In 2015, he co-authored a book with Ryan Manis titled Cyber War versus Cyber Realities, Cyber Conflict in the International System. Together, they used empirical data to examine cyber attacks and the effects on international conflict dynamics, and their findings challenged the conventional wisdom put forth by policymakers and academics. Brandon Verliano's talk was recorded on October 5th at the University of Utah.
So I want to talk about cyber victory. I want to talk about the utility of cyber conflict. This is a sequel to my book I did with Ryan Manis on cyber war versus cyber realities, which Sean kind of highlighted a minute ago. But in this, we kind of look at the dynamics and the scope of cyber conflict. We challenge conventional wisdom because the reality is that this conflict, this type of warfare is talked about, but there's little evidence of it. And that's what we kind of document in this book. But then the next question would be, there is some cyber conflict. There is cyber warfare in some sense. But the real question would be, what is the utility of this conflict? What is the future of warfare? How can this sort of tactic or strategy be used in international relations, in diplomacy, and in the military? So in the arena of security, cyber conflict, and associated strategies, this is potentially one of the most important military innovations of recent decades. If you were to look at this from the perspective of the news, from the perspective of military organizations, from the perspective of the proliferation of cyber weaponry, you would think this is the greatest change that we've ever seen in the history of mankind. Well, I'm not going to deny that the internet and associated digital technologies is probably the greatest advance we've had in the last 100 years. There is a question as to the utility of this form of warfare in diplomatic and military uses. So the evolution of this new technology has brought upon a proposed revolution of military affairs. And this is this idea of a complete reorganization of how we use militarized and diplomatic tools. It promises a great deal of coercive advantage and ability to the attacker. But we theorize that cyber power is not wholly sufficient on its own to alter the calculus of conflict, that people have gone a bit too far in their assumptions about how cyber conflict will be used and how it can be used. And the real question is, what does victory mean in cyberspace? Are cyber tactics effective means in changing the will of the defender? I really want to know if there's an alternation, or if this really impacts the defender, if this really changes behavior. That's the real question. Because of course cyber, of course the internet, of course all these things matter. But the question is really, do they have an impact? And if they don't have an impact, this might suggest we're going down the wrong direction and how we build future forces and how we plan to fight future battles. War, of course, is a political instrument. The goals of operation are always driven by political objectives. So we have to keep this in mind. And if the weapons we utilize for war or diplomacy are not suited for achieving advances in the battlefield or in the military or diplomatically, then we have to question the weapon. We have to question its utility. We have to question how it's used. Or it may just be an additive weapon. I think a lot of people have gone a bit too far in thinking of this future of cyber war, when in reality, this tool is probably more useful for espionage and disruption, which I'll explain in a minute. For cyber weapons, the result could be they're more useful in the imagination and fiction, rather than an effective means of altering the distribution of power. If cyber conflict is not an effective method of marshaling power, either by the state or non-state actor, then we must rethink the importance of cyber and its centrality to warfighting diplomacy. But if you just watch any sort of news program, you watch any debate, cybersecurity has become the most important topic that people talk about. But the reality of the issue is that people speak about it in such empty terms. They don't really talk about what this really means. Dr. Lawson and I wrote a blog before where we talked about the term cyber bombs. The US government talked about how they're dropping cyber bombs on ISIS. But what they really meant by cyber bombs was really about disruption and disorganization tactics. It's about trying to change spreadsheets, literally. That's what they mean by cyber bombs. But the terms they use and the analogies they use are perhaps unsuited for the reality of how this tactic is used. And that prevents problems for how we organize and how we think about this strategy. So cyber strategies and coercion, our treatment of the efficacy of cyber power emphasizes coercion as a method. In this respect, cyber conflict is the use of manipulation, denial, and punishment strategies on the digital frontier. So that's really what coercion is. Coercion is about manipulating, denying access, or punishing the opposition so that they change their behavior. So that's really what we're interested in, because that's what people talk about when they suggest that these are important strategies or important weapons. Our hypothesis is that cyber power, defined as the ability to control and apply typical forms of domination in cyberspace, has coercive potential, but more likely coercive potential for disruption and espionage, not for denial and compellence. And denial and compellence are the real keys, because you want to compel the adversary to changing behavior. You want to make ISIS back down. You want to make Iran not build nuclear weapons. You want to make Ukraine give up. That's how you use these weapons if you're trying to use them for compellence. But the question we ask, is cyber really a tool for compellence? And we think that cyber strategies likely do not achieve effects in isolation, and this might challenge the discourse that warfare would be net-centric in the future. I think what warfare will be in the future is we will use net, internet, computer, digital tools, but as solely net weapons, this is not necessarily a useful tactic to use. Coercion is the power to hurt. It's a threat of the potential for escalating damage of your forces that would force your opponent to yield. It's about escalating costs until you change behavior in the opposition. That's what coercion is. The language is used towards military diplomacy, but you can use it in everyday daily life. Leaders seek to optimize coercive strategies to influence decision-making processes as opposed to achieving decisive battlefield outcomes. The majority of people would suggest that actually when you have to fight in the battlefield, that's when you lose. You want to coerce the opposition to back down before you even get to the battlefield. So that's why the diplomatic process of cyber weaponry and cyber strategy is so important. They develop punishment, risk, and denial strategies that often reinforce other instruments of power. But when you read about cyber tactics and cyber strategy, people might seem to kind of suggest to you that this is a solo operation. It's an operation that's done on its own. It's something that can be used to change behavior. And that's really a question we have. So our theory, if the goal is to compel and change behavior, is this method effective? This is a key question. And this is a problem with the discourse in cybersecurity, because we don't really ask, is this method effective? Let's say Russia did hack US electoral systems. Let's say they did hack the DNC and probably also the RNC. The question then would be, is this an effective method of changing behavior in America? Is this going to make America more likely to side and support Russia in their international operations? And the answer is probably no, unlikely. But it might make the American public distrust electoral systems. So therefore, this would be a tactic of disruption. And disruption doesn't exactly change the behavior of the enemy in a way that might be beneficial to you. But it does change the behavior of the opposition. That's likely the goal of Russia. But the goal of Russia in achieving some sort of grand change in how America operates, that would be very difficult to do. the other thing is the history of technology innovation is often vastly overstated. We have these stories about air power changing how we fight wars, how we win wars. But if you really investigate air power, there's a lot of questions as to if it's ever been effective. In Persian Gulf War, we've kind of gone back and said that it wasn't useful. In World War II, we've kind of gone back and said that it wasn't useful. You know, the example of basically the Russians moving all their supplies and production behind the Ural Mountains so they couldn't be bombed demonstrates there are limitations to air power. The same with the tank. It took a long time, 20, 30 years, for the tank to be useful on the battlefield. And it's still not exactly clear that it ever was useful on the battlefield. And this is a story that goes on over and over again with technology. We talk about the longbow and the Battle of Agincourt and how that changed tactics. But then what they don't talk about is how you need cavalry to chase down the bowmen once you unleash an initial salvo. That really, technology is about combined tactics. But that story isn't that interesting. And that's the problem. We want to tell these interesting stories, but when we tell these interesting stories, we sacrifice empirical accuracy. We sacrifice the truth. And that's the real question we have to think about. What is the usefulness of these tactics? And if we overstate our emphasis on these tactics and potentially create unintended consequences. We also know very little about theory of espionage and disruption and how that might achieve impact in the opposition. And one of the things I want to highlight is the need for political science, the need for military studies, the need for STEM studies to think more about these other sorts of tools, these tools of disruption. We think about these grand strategic plans. You know, every day I read things about grand strategy in America. We need to think about grand strategy all over the world. But what does grand strategy mean in the context of espionage? What does grand strategy mean in the context of disruption? We don't think about these lower level operations that much, and I think it's critical that we start to think about these issues as we have seen a decline in major power warfare. The question is really about the end. What is the impact for disruption and espionage? What do we do with this information? So if China takes, you know, 20 million fingerprint records from everyone who's ever worked for an American security contractor, what does that mean? Are they going to go around and do some Mission Impossible sort of operation to take your fingerprints and to go into a building? Is that really how they do espionage now? Is that really how we make effects and change behavior? That's really a question we need to think about. And the reality is that punishment and risk operations, as Robert Pape says in his book, Bombing to Win, are very, very difficult. Denial can work. Punishment can work if you're willing to punish civilians, if you're willing to really go all out to destroy the opposition. But then in modern diplomacy and modern international affairs, these things are very questionable and it's very problematic to go that far. So we have a few case examples first. Yeah, everyone talks about the power of cyber warfare, but I think the most prominent cases we have lately kind of question the power of cyber warfare. You have Sandworm Black Energy, which was the hack of the Ukrainian power plant that happened in 2016. 80,000 customers were without power. 80,000 customers were without power at 3 a.m. No one noticed. They basically went to the substations and switched to breakers. So the majority of power was back on within a few hours. But if you read Wired, if you read the news organization reports about these operations, these seem to be the greatest things ever, harbingers of the future. Things are going to change now. But if you really dive into what happened, if you ask what really changed, there's really a question. Stuxnet is our World War I in cyber war. We talk about it all the time. Everyone has a story of Stuxnet, which was the operation to change and impact Iran's behavior so they don't build nuclear weapons, or also to change Iran's behavior so that Israel doesn't bomb them right away. But the impact is really uncertain. I can't remember my stats off the top of my head, but I believe that 11% of centrifuges in Iran in the Natanz plant were taken out. The problem is the centrifuges they were using were so old and so bad, they were called the Pintos of centrifuges. And I don't think you guys know what Pintos are. But Pintos were those types of cars in the 80s that would just blow up by an impact. There was a 10% fail rate in those centrifuges anyways. So if Stuxnet worked and we took out 11%, on a centrifuge that would fail at a 10% rate anyways, we cannot statistically distinguish what actually changed, what behavior actually impacted the opposition. And the reality is that Iran actually went through all their centrifuges, fixed them all, brought more online and made more operational, and actually increased uranium enrichment. So if the goal was to reduce uranium enrichment, we actually really, really failed there. And then Shamoon is another great operation where Iran basically retaliated against America by attacking Saudi Arabia because they're scared to attack America, so they attacked Saudi Arabia's oil operations. The thing that happened, though, is they wiped thousands of computers, but no viable company will keep important data on a single computer. So they didn't lose any operations, they didn't lose any data, they just lost physical computers, and they just replaced them. So there was really no loss in data or operations. And I've already questioned the utility of the Chinese theft operations. The other thing we would also need to think about, if China's been stealing military technology for decades, they've been stealing war plans, drone plans, has it actually changed China in that they are more effective warfighters now? And a lot of people will question that. A lot of people would also suggest that, let's say China stole drone plans from American contractors. What's more important, stealing drone plans from American contractors or going to Israel and buying them at an arms fair? You know, that's the kind of problem we have, is we think this internet operations are so important, but when you really dive into them, they become a bit questionable. So we have data. Of course, I will admit data is subjective. Data is problematic, but we do the best we can. I'm firmly convinced that cyber operations are very public just because they are attacking public networks. So the secrecy of this sort of domain is a bit overstated. But this research was based on extensive coding operations for the last 5 years with many controls, many students involved, many sorts of reliability and validity checks. But this is still a representative sample. We don't know about every cyber operation. We're only focused on cyber operations between rival states or states that are already fighting. So that means we leave out Canada. Is Canada really important? Yeah. It just kind of depends how much you like maple and things like that. We leave out Germany, of course, but the goal is to get more funding so we can code these countries in the future.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Today we are airing a talk recorded recently of Brandon Valeriano. He's an author, a lecturer, and a researcher on the subject of cyber warfare. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, in their entirety as a public service. Today we are airing a talk given a few weeks ago by Brandon Valeriano. He is an author and a researcher on the subject of cyber conflict. Last year he co-authored the book, Cyber War versus Cyber Realities, Cyber Conflict in the International System, in which he argues that cyber attacks, such as the large-scale disruption of websites felt last week, actually have a limited impact. He argues that acts of cyber warfare undertaken by states may be useful for espionage or disruption, but little else. And ultimately, large-scale cyber conflicts, if they're successful, will mostly hurt civilians. Here is Valeriano.
These are cyber operations through the years from 2000 to 2014. So one thing you notice here is that the total of cyber operations or cyber incidents between rival countries is increasing. You see that through the blue line, the top line, that there are a lot of cyber operations, that there's basically a mountain up there. But the reality is, if you look at compel and deny operations, operations really meant to change the behavior of the opposition. They are very much at the bottom. They're that yellow line at the bottom. And you see a spike in 2009, likely associated with Stuxnet, but the majority of cyber operations are espionage and disruption. And disruption is what we call DDoS and things like that, where you're just trying to distract and just annoy the enemy. Or even students have started to do that. I thought it was kind of amazing, but in Britain, you know, we have plagiarism software. They DDoS the plagiarism software during the universal due date. So everyone got a week-long extension. So does that change the behavior of the grader? No. It gives everyone a week more. That's what a disruption operation really is. So we see that's the picture of cyber operations. The thing that we're really interested in is the impact, the success rate of cyber operations. And here we see a variation that's it's pretty clear. I have a better table that comes next. But by country, you see a large variation. Where America is very successful, North Korea fails all the time. China's decent. Russia's quite good. Iran's, it's pretty good at disruption, but not very good at coercion. Israel is probably the best in terms of success rates. And you see success rates vary by country. Also, you see democracies tend to be more successful than autocracies. But I never put much utility in types of governments in terms of outcomes. But that's an interesting kind of finding we have so far. Another way to look at it would be these bar charts. I don't know, it's tough to really visualize this, but what you see here is the kind of brown thing right there. That's compel and deny operations. That's Stuxnet. That's Black Energy. That's trying to make Ukraine back down during the war with Russia. And what you see is impactful or successful, whatever word you want to use for that, the count of successful operations is very, very low. Whereas espionage, you see they are more likely to be successful than not. And the same with disruption. So you see the wide variation between how you code these operations. If these operations are to change the behavior of the opposition, they're unlikely to be successful. But if the operation is to simply annoy the opposition or to steal information from the opposition, they are likely to be successful. And that should tell us something about the cyber era. The cyber era is not an era of war. It's an era of information warfare. That's how we started in this field. We started talking about information warfare, and then people got excited about terms like cyber war, cyber Pearl Harbor, cyber 9/11, this sort of great utility in cyber warfare. And we have to question this, because really, how would that work? How are you going to get America to back down any conflict just because you attack them through cyber operations? The real question is about the salience of the issue. If the issue is so salient and so important, a country is not going to back down until they lose everything. And that's really the question. We can't use cyber operations to make China back down over Taiwan because they believe Taiwan to be an existential threat. Nor could Russia use cyber operations to make the Ukraine back down and give up Crimea because they believe Crimea to be an existential threat to their existence. So just how salient these operations are, just how they're connected to the international issue, is a critical event and a critical thing we need to talk about. But you don't hear about these issues. You don't hear about the context of operations when the news talks about these things. These are the most impactful, the most successful cyber operations. These are the ones that you would say, these are the stars in the data set. You see the majority here are espionage operations. There's only one denial operation, and that was a massive botnet campaign against Chinese espionage organizations in 2008 to get China to stop hacking us. And that did work. China stopped hacking us for a few years. They went right back at it in about 2012, 2013. And then they stopped once again. But when they stopped once again, they did that because President Xi and Obama signed a multilateral agreement about how they're going to behave in cyberspace. So you see, likely, and where we're going with this project is we need to really look at combined strategies. And I think combined with military operations is not really going to be useful. But when you combine cyber operations with legal and diplomatic maneuvers, you can see them having a real impact and a real effect. And that's really, I think, where we need to go. That the real story is something different. The real story is something about diplomacy and positive actions.
You're good.
Okay. I always got to have a picture of the hacker with the, I don't know how you type with gloves, but sure, okay. So this is a cross-tabulation, investigation of the data. What's interesting here is, let's say for compel and deny at the bottom, I don't have a pointer. But so the count is, there are 17 compel and deny operations in our data set of 165. 15 of them failed, 2 worked. Just based on how the data is configured, you would expect 6.6 to fail, but we found 15 fail. So more likely than not, we're seeing an odd distribution of how the numbers work. We should see more successes just based on chance, but we don't. And this should tell us something about how this operation really works. So we find a course of measures in the more benign form succeed around a level of expectations. Cyber incidents intended to compel or deny, however, tend to fail much more often than not. This would suggest that we've gotten the cyber era wrong. It's not a domain of war and compellence, but a domain of information asymmetries and disruption. That's really what we need to talk about, but that's less sexy than cyber war. That's less interesting than cyber war. But the reality of how the world works is often less interesting than people want to make it out to be. The next question we need to ask is about how these different course of cyber techniques are effective when paired with other conventional coercive measures. And that's what we're doing right now. We have a massive data set. We're working on that. We should be done within the next month. But like I said, the teaser would be that likely these cyber operations are more effective when paired with diplomacy and when paired with legal maneuvers, which paradoxically you wouldn't think would work. Institutions in cyber don't work, but norms seem to work because people are so scared of the potential impact on civilians. And that's the real problem with cyber war, is that you cannot distinguish between a military target and a civilian target in cyberspace. These targets bleed together. There is no distinction between who the enemy is and who the enemy isn't because of how cyberspace is used. Are cyber weapons alone able to help states achieve victory? This question is complex, but evidence presented here that the answer is likely no. Given these preliminary findings, though, as we're only in the beginning of the age of cyberpower, we must consider caution in operations. This may change. But I think the effectiveness of new weapons is often overstated. It's often overestimated because people like new toys. People like to talk about new weapons. But the reality is new toys and new weapons are often not as effective as older toys and older weapons that people have used for generations and decades. Are cyber weapons cyber weapons are not effective, of course, of intent. Then what are they good for? The clear advantage comes in espionage and disruption. But these options have limited value. What are you going to do with 20 million records as a country if you're China? You're going to create profiles. You're going to figure out who works where, who's a CIA operative. But this is not a world of James Bond. This is no longer a world where spying really happens on the ground. This is not really a world where these old kind of techniques really work anymore. The majority of spying operations and espionage operations are just information collection efforts like Snowden demonstrated to us. If the cyber domain is mainly useful as a vector of information warfare, as a field we must turn back to examine the issue before we can fully understand the and consider the usefulness of cyber weapons. We need theories of disruption and espionage. We don't need theories of cyber war. I think that's the wrong path. So I'll end with the cyber. That's what Donald Trump calls it. I think we should just go with that. I like the cyber. Does cyber have the power to hurt? Depends on how you view the concept. I don't think it's as transformational as many think. But we need to investigate this in terms of the correlates of success and failure in combination with other tactics. But this is a book. We're doing some case studies. But I'm also interested in hearing ideas from you as we go along and complete this project.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just tuning in, a few weeks ago, Brandon Valeriano spoke at the Hinckley Institute of Politics about the realities of cyber warfare. His talk was recorded about a week before last week's large-scale attack on the Internet that affected multiple services. Valeriano contends that the Internet is certainly vulnerable, but that cyber warfare has its limitations as a strategy.
Okay, so I know you mentioned the term the cyber Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. I think that phrase was coined by Secretary of Defense. And when he brought it up, he kind of talked about this idea of all of our critical infrastructure simultaneously being hacked and like the world falling into chaos. Mm-hmm. In your research, have you seen like any evidence that our critical infrastructure could be vulnerable to this sort of cyber attack?
Yeah. So it's a great question. Dr. Sean Lawson there just did a paper on the term Cyber Pearl Harbor. It's a 30-year-old term, right? It was used to a limited effect, and then Panetta used it, and then the use spiked after that. But yeah, it's really about attacks on critical infrastructure. I think people forget that Pearl Harbor failed from the Japanese perspective, but they just like to use that term. Now, is our critical infrastructure vulnerable? Yes, of course. But there's a great article in Foreign Policy by Cyber Squirrel. Really, Cyber Squirrel, that's the author. And they demonstrate that squirrels are more effective and organized in attacking critical infrastructure than cyber. That really, the majority of failures we see in the power plants are caused by squirrels eating through power lines. Our critical infrastructure is flawed. But does it mean that that will be attacked by opposition, that it'll be attacked by Russia? No, it doesn't exactly mean that that's how things will happen. But the other thing is, if it is, we must look to ourselves and protect ourselves and defend ourselves. These systems are run by controllers that were made in the 80s. You know, nuclear power systems and nuclear missiles are run by, they're still on Windows 97. You know, we really need to think about what we're doing. And a lot of people don't want to change these systems because it requires a lot of work to change the operating systems. But the reality is that Silicon Valley feels very guilty. And they feel very guilty. There's a lot of money out there in foundations for people doing research on cybersecurity because the people who built the internet did not build the internet for safety. And there's a lot of things we need to do to rethink that issue. But the way I'm going with my research is I'm looking more towards cyber repression now. And the idea that states will use cyber tools not against other states, because it's not an effective tactic to change the behavior of the opposition, but they will use these tools against opposition, activists, protesters, and journalists. And that's really how we're seeing these tools used. So cyber tools are not going to be used against critical infrastructure, as I predict and hope. But they're using these against individuals, the weakest. Amnesty International no longer has cybersecurity because they just gave up. There's no point. They put everything on the internet. I was in an Uber car the other day with a Turkish journalist. He was kicked out of his country. He's in America. He's hiding. He's attacked every day. That's the real cyber war. That's where things are really happening. That's where the danger really is. If there is a danger to critical infrastructure, we must look to ourselves to protect it and fix it.
So in contrast to that, when you mentioned fixing the infrastructure, essentially that was never meant to, I don't know, be a firewall in itself, how do you compare military targets, such as the one like Israel attacked, with our water supply? Because to my knowledge, most of our water is regulated through computer systems instead of analog. And I don't know if there's actually similarities between the two, so forgive my ignorance. But if a country is DDoSed on their water supply, how does that affect the rest of the ripple effect for the nation's security?
Well, that's one of the things, is that if you were to attack these things, let's say you do a DDoS against a bank, and you can't get into your bank account for 2 days, that targets the confidence one has in a state. That if you lack confidence in your state to protect yourself, that could be a win for the opposition. So that's how you might connect it. But yeah, this is the problem, is that people speculate about everything. We have become future prognosticators in the field of cybersecurity, which is strange because the field of political science, the field of policy analysis, all these military fields that deal with diplomacy and military issues have become more scientific and more evidence-based. But the field of cybersecurity, the field of AI, the field of drones is all about what could be. But I think what we really need to think about is what actually is. Might Russia attack a water plant? Maybe, but we really need to think about protecting our water supplies even more so from domestic enemies. If you look at the rates of terrorism, the majority of terrorist events come from domestic enemies. So we do need to protect ourselves, but we need to think about what are the costs and what are the advantages of protecting different sorts of systems. And that's the real critical question. That we need to think about a whole nation approach to reforming our critical infrastructure. But that's so difficult, and it's such a massive problem. But that might go towards this idea of, say, a national service. A lot of people talk about using cybersecurity professionals to work in ROTC as like advisors and things like that. That we need to start to think about this, because the military is not about running around with a gun anymore and shooting people. A lot of things we need to do to protect our nation are a lot of basic financial and computer and digital things, and we don't think about how everyone can contribute. And that's something we need to really, really focus on in the future, but I don't really think we are.
So you mentioned drones in your last answer, and espionage has been the highest success rate in cyber attacks. If, say, a foreign country hacked a U.S. drone and then fired missiles somewhere in the Middle East, how do you see that affecting the geo and political landscape, I guess?
Yeah, that would be incredibly impactful. It'd be incredibly interesting, but that's one of those things of, could it happen? Would it happen? Is that really what Russia would do? But the thing I kind of suggest, like, let's look at Skyfall, the James Bond movie. If you guys remember that movie, not to give away any spoilers, but they blow up MI6. And the thing I always talk about is, when they blow up MI6, whose fault is that? It probably was the electrician that allowed them to set up a system where you can blow up an entire building just through a cyber attack. That doesn't make sense. So we need to think about command and control. If our drones are able to fire weapons from a remote place and be stolen from that sort of scenario that you're putting forward, we really need to think about what we're doing with these distance weapons. And a lot of people talk about drones and AI from the perspective of methods of control. And the worry that people have with AI and drones is that we're losing functional control over these weapons. And that you really want someone with a direct control over that weapon, whether that be line of sight or whatever. But I think that's one of the problems a lot of the ethicists highlight. I'm not so sure I support that idea. That's one of the things we need to think about. As we build these systems, the vulnerabilities we enter or create in these systems can harm us just as much as they can harm the opposition. So what happens when we release drones? What happens if we release 1,000 drones against China in a war? What happens if they're hacked? That's a real problem. Or I was talking to my friend the other day about, let's say you use cyber to bring down radar installations as you attack a country. The problem with that, though, is your probability of success is likely 20 to 40%. So you're going in there assuming that your cyber attack will bring down the radar installations of the opposition, but you're not sure because you've never tested it. You can't test it, because if you do test it, they'll know you're going to do it and they'll protect themselves from doing it. So your confidence is low. The other thing is, let's say it does work. Let's say you bring down all the air defense systems. You can never do that again, because they will prevent that from happening. They will shore up all those zero-day exploits. So this is the thing that we need to think about in terms of cyber operations. The utility and the probability of these things working is so low, we probably do not want to depend on them. But people love the idea of future technologies. But the reality is that future technologies are not things that people depend on the battlefield, because the probability of success can be very, it varies quite a bit. New tanks fall apart. New tanks break down quite often because they don't have the parts to repair them. We tend to rely on older technologies because we're assured that they'll work. And that's the issue we have with cyber, is that we're not assured it will work. But no one talks about this. And I don't know why this has become such an unexplored issue. Because what I'm doing is basically popping the cyber bubble and saying all the stuff we're doing, it probably isn't going to work. And probably the unintended consequences in harming activists and protesters is probably more important than the actual military benefits. And I think that's the real story. But that's not as interesting. It's not going to be a 60-minute, hour-long segment. Well, maybe it will, but so far it's not.
Since our forces are more reliant on technology, aren't we more vulnerable to cyber attacks on the battlefield?
Yeah, and that's what scares me the most. Like, let's say, a lot of you probably played first-person shooters, right? You have heads-up display. You have this thing where all your allies are. They actually built that. DARPA built that. So the idea was that any phone can have instantaneous battlefield locations of all your allies, of everyone on your team. Sounds like a great idea. The problem is, if you do that, the opposition can get that too. So if we depend on these technologies, if we depend on GPS, they also can make us more vulnerable. And that's really another direction I want to go in my research. I want to look at the biological and physical dependencies we have on cyber technologies. How has it changed us as people? Who is more likely to be dependent and why? We don't ask these questions, but I think we've seen a significant change in human behavior through digital dependence. But we haven't interrogated this issue because we just assume it to be true. Or like someone older will say, that's just something a 14-year-old kid will do. But I've seen many older people who are just as dependent on digital technology as younger people. So there's an intense variation that we need to really think about. But it also goes into what we call resilience, that we don't focus really on resilience and what it means to recover. Like Sebastian Younger just wrote a book called Tribes. And one of the theses in the book called Tribes is about how in ancient societies, when they went to war, they would have a cleansing ritual to kind of re-enter them into society. But we don't do that anymore. We don't think about the separation between war and societal interactions. We don't think about what it might mean to be dependent on digital technologies. What happens when a drone operator kills people in Afghanistan and then goes home to dinner to their family that same night? And the reality is that PTSD rates are higher for drone operators than they are for traditional pilots. So this digital dependency, this digital interaction has intense effects on people who protect us. But we don't really think about the biology of these issues. And I think there's a lot of research to be done in that area.
This is working? Okay. My name is Alondra, and I just wanted to know how this would play out with non-state actors. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about the biological effects. So let's say it's not Russia against the United States, but non-state actor like ISIS. Obviously, what if their goal is to deter us, not necessarily from acting, but to distract us? Let's say, not necessarily attacking the United States, but there have been attacks here in the United States. How do we know that their attacks on the cyber network infiltrating information won't hurt us in a physical aspect like 9/11 or anything else if they were connected?
Sure. So one thing is that we can never be secure. The idea of security is an illusion. There is never complete security. But the thing that kind of should make us feel a bit better about this is that while non-state actors cannot be deterred, they will use any aggressive tactic they can to harm the opposition. They also are remarkably ineffective in their operations. They also generally fail all the time. And one of the things about cyber operations, that's why I have this guy up here, because Donald Trump said that Russia didn't hack the DNC. It was a 400-pound guy on his bed. That's not how cyber works. There's not a bunch of kids in a basement hacking people. The people who do this, and I did this when I was younger, they do this for status. They do this for recognition in their communities, in their tribe. They don't do this because they are malicious anarchists. They do this because it's a community that they're building that they want recognition. And more often than not, the hackers that are younger actually can be generally converted to be white hat hackers, to be hackers for the government because they want pension plans. They want a steady income. They don't want to live in a basement and, you know, try and hack people and make money that way. It doesn't work out too well for them. Same thing in Russia. Russia has a huge problem with cyber hackers. But the government in Russia has made it so that you cannot operate in the internet without direct connection to your passport or your ID. So they know everyone who's doing this. So the idea of this lawless West isn't really true. That Russia allows hackers to operate as long as it's in their interests. But when it goes too far, they will stop it. So there is a limitation on non-state actors in that their capabilities generally are not that good. So that does make me feel better. But there could be a black swan. There could be someone who can come through and destroy everything. Sure. But in reality, how many anarchists are out there? How many people are really out there who just want to destroy and hurt everything? That wasn't the ideology of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda wanted to kick us out of the Middle East.
They didn't hate our freedoms. They hated where we were. So we also need to think about the consequences of the things we do and the things we may trigger. And that if we're going to go around the world and have international operations, we need to think about defense. And we haven't thought a lot about defense and defending our critical infrastructure. And that's the real question we need to think about, because we're likely more vulnerable than we think.
Okay, so a couple of things that I've gleaned from what you said is that defense is probably our ultimate goal, but the question I have is, if that's the case, then is it mimicking like an Iron Curtain scenario, the firewall, and kind of like a Garden of Eden with the angel with the fiery sword, like we determine who goes in and who goes out, or basically nobody gets in. What I have to say about that, though, is I've heard in terms of sports analogies that the best offense will always beat the best defense. Mm-hmm. So in that case, coming from the space race with the Cold War, and we had this enthusiasm to be there first, or at least to hit the moon first, do we have that same rallying going on within government or security channels that is basically the ultimate goal is to set the pace of the race, since there's ultimately no complete defense? And I hope I was very clear, and I'm sorry if I wasn't.
No, that's fine. I mean, it's really something we're thinking about, but then we don't have a Manhattan Project for this. The U.S. military is looking for what they call the third offset. And basically the second offset was these GPS technologies that allowed us to do so well in the wars in the Middle East. They're looking for this new silver bullet that will allow the American military to beat any opposition. But have we really focused on a way to make the silver bullet? I don't think we have. But the other thing is, like, this idea of a silver bullet and this sort of third offset is probably an unrealistic goal. I think what we really need is a whole-of-nation operation to defend ourselves. But also, in how we defend ourselves, there's a trade-off. And we can go too far in limiting civil liberties. I think one of the problems we have with cyber operations is that the tools that states gather to use against other states can just as well be used against individuals they don't like. So that's one of the key problems, is that we're not focused on protecting individuals. We're not focused on protecting key human rights activists that probably are more vulnerable than states. States can handle this. States can protect themselves. The American government can do very well at making sure that their systems are resilient. The one who can't is Sony, who obviously failed repeatedly and were warned repeatedly, but they always fail. And that's something we need to think about, is a lot of computer systems don't invest in computer security. They make the IT guy, the guy who sets up the network, also defend the network. But now those things are two different jobs. But we like to think it's the same job. So this is something we need to think about as we build systems and as we build companies. We're becoming a service economy. We're an economy that doesn't build things. We're an economy that focuses more on information. But as we build information systems, information technology and how we set up the system isn't the same thing as how we secure the system. So we need to invest now equally and infrastructure for digital systems, but also protection of digital systems. But the way the equation works is we invest this much in infrastructure and this much in protection. And now the rise is what we call cyber insurance. And I'm really curious how well that's going to work, because now we have cyber insurance like we have flood insurance. But then will that really work? Like, to me, the analogy is really about bike insurance. Have you ever had bike insurance and got a bike stolen? Or is that just a British thing? Like, I had bike insurance, and I got my bike stolen, and then they said I didn't have the right lock. So they didn't pay me for the bike. So that's the real thing, is like, will cyber insurance actually protect people? Will it make people more complacent in how they work and operate? And that's the real fear, is that we really need to think about digital security. We really need to think about what we put on the internet. You know, do you have your bank account on your phone? Is that a good idea? I think it's a good idea if they use your fingerprint, but if not, I wouldn't put it on your phone. That's a whole new area of cybersecurity, is mobile cybersecurity, especially in Africa, where they don't necessarily use laptops. They focus on using mobile phones. And we need to think about this sort of mobile security too, but we don't, because we're kind of assured that these systems we have work so well. But that's how things have worked so far. The question is about the future and what we can do. And I don't think we should think about massive cyber war. I think we need to think about the basic day-to-day things we do that can make us more insecure. Last point is my favorite story about this is the U.S. military did a study on military people who collect on malicious links, U.S. military people within military networks who basically give money to Nigeria. They looked at who did this, and the majority of people said, it was too early, I didn't have coffee, I wasn't thinking. That's really their excuse. And it's just so, we don't think about the consequences of our actions online. What we give away and what can be taken from us because of how open we are. And that's a real problem. So I think we're going to wrap up. I thank you all for listening to me. I thank you all for inviting me. I checked Utah off my state list, saw everything. So it's been a great visit, and now I must head to the airport. So thank you.
Brandon Valeriano is an author and a researcher on the subject of cyber conflict. He spoke a few weeks ago at the University of Utah. You can hear his entire talk again on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour podcast. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss, your humble curator and producer of this program. Thanks for listening.